G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute. The Australian media industry, particularly journalism, was already going through a major disruption well before the pandemic hit. And tech titans like Facebook and Google have seriously eaten into advertising revenue, particularly for newspapers. Margaret Simons in The Guardian has reported that at least 51 news media outlets and newsrooms have closed since the beginning of the coronavirus crisis, many of them local newspapers. Just this week, the government announced that the ACCC would force Facebook and Google to share advertising revenue with Australian media companies, while News Corp has told the ACCC that Google should be broken up to restore a level playing field for media companies, because they're just so huge and have such overwhelming market power.
Tech giants including Google and Facebook will now have to cough up the cash for news content in Australia.
The news that 60 newspapers around the country could be going digital.
Then coronavirus hit, restrictions shutting down local businesses.
First thing they did was pull their advertising, which was our lifeline.
Australian Associated Press, Australia's domestic news agency, is to close.
The BBC has come under really unusual pressure.
ABC could be made to sell off its Sydney and Melbourne headquarters in order to save money.
We did a lot. Look. You know you're a fake. You know that. Your whole network, the way you cover it, is fake.
Today we're bringing you some special guests from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. The chair of Thomson Reuters Trustees and former CEO of News Corp Australia, Kim Williams. Walkley Award-winning journalist, author and broadcaster, Quentin Dempster, and of course our chief economist, Richard Dennis.
Kim, we'll start with you. You have obviously been a media executive for much of your career. Exactly how much trouble is the media industry in right now?
I would think that the media is confronting the worst body of settings that it has encountered since the Second World War. In fact, some years ago, The Economist coined an acronym, VUCA or VUCA, for the kinds of torment that media is going through with digital disruption. It stood for volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity being the bywords of digital disruption. And certainly we have now not just digital disruption, but economic disruption as a consequence of COVID-19 and the actions governments have had to take. And clearly that's hammered the media in a very severe way. What was already an industry that was not processing change particularly well, especially in our country, has been compounded by all of the externalities that have compounded the problem media was already confronting.
Quentin, as a journalist, how much has this disruption to the media industry, even before the pandemic, had an impact on journalism specifically?
Jobs have vaporised. Journalist jobs and all the career paths we hope for all the budding journalists of Australia have vaporised. There have been some startups which are good, but they're just a handful of replacement jobs, Ebony. The thing is, with COVID-19, audiences are up. Everybody wants what the media is doing across the board. But as Kim said, the advertising revenues, particularly in regional, have collapsed. Some of the metro papers are getting good government advertising, and those Harvey Norman wraparounds make it look as though something's happening. But we've got to wait to see exactly what has happened with the collapse of advertising for what's called mainstream media. Regional print is going. It's gone. Big question for all of us here is what's going to happen to metro print. How long will that take before it goes?
Thanks, Quentin. Just a reminder for participants who I can still see joining us. There's a Q&A function if you'd like to type out a question for later on for the panelists. Richard, I might ask you next. Why is the business model for the media industry so challenging?
Well, we don't like to talk about it, but once upon a time it was classified ads for cars and jobs that funded quality journalism in Australia. The when I was a kid, the Sydney Morning Herald on a Saturday was an inch thick, and half of that was secondhand car sales and jobs that I wasn't at all interested in applying for. And the rivers of gold, as they were called from the tabloids, from the classifieds, used to fund an enormous amount of media. Well, those days are gone, obviously. And now the potential replacement is online advertising. So what we're seeing is an enormous fight between the producers of content, the newspapers that employ journalists, and to some extent the distributors of content, and that's the Googles and the Facebooks. We're seeing an enormous fight over who should get the lion's share of that revenue. Now, as is often the case in economics, the person with the most market power wins, and Google's been able to, not just in Australia but around the world, play newspapers off against each other, play media proprietors off against each other. Facebook, similarly, has been able to gradually accumulate an incredibly dominant position, and at the moment they're making off with most of the advertising revenue. So advertising revenues collapsed from classifieds over a long period of time. There's certainly plenty of potential to get plenty of advertising revenue via on advertising, but at the moment it's just a classic economic fight between producers and distributors about who gets the lion's share of the revenue. And this week we've seen the Commonwealth government step in to say it's going to help the media proprietors in their fight with Google and Facebook to try and redistribute some of that enormous amount of cash, most of which at the moment is flowing offshore and untaxed.
Kim, obviously we had a pretty big announcement this week. We've had the ACCC Digital Platforms inquiry, and that was supposed to be kind of a voluntary code being developed there, but because of the pandemic, presumably they're accelerating that and making it mandatory. And the idea there is to force Facebook and Google to be sharing their revenue and paying for the content, essentially, that they're using. Do you think this approach is going to work?
Well, we'll see. The ACCC, when it issued its report, indicated that it had confidence this could be worked out by way of a negotiation between the digital platforms and media proprietors. I think the general view in the industry at that time was that was a forlorn objective and that it would always fail and would require intervention either by a regulator like the ACMA or the ACCC. As to whether the ACCC has a kind of skill set to price appropriately for the rampant theft that occurs by digital platforms of produced content, which is a reflection of a very great investment on the part of media companies, is yet to be seen. I have an open mind about it, but I don't see the announcement on Monday as anything other than presaging a process to happen. It's not an outcome yet.
Yeah, and it hasn't been very successful, certainly. I think based on we're using competition laws, and places like Spain, where it was a copyright issue, certainly didn't have much.
Well, it's not just Spain, it's also France and Germany. So that there have been very significant movements in Europe, and we're yet to see the EU implement a directive across the whole of the EU, which then requires that each one of the independent nations in the EU enact it in their own jurisdictions. I'm hopeful but sceptical.
Well, Kim, this is an opportunity for everybody in the industry to help Rod Sims, because
he put his
hands and said, give us a hand, tell us how we can design this. From your experience in the Copyright Agency, it's beyond a copyright, according to Sims. It's more competition policy. But how could we design something that would give content creators, journalists, media content creators, companies, and individuals a share of the revenues that Facebook and Google gather from getting the eyeballs, aggregating the eyeballs to their sites before it's linked on and trafficked to others?
Well, as you will recall, Quentin, the Copyright Agency actually made a very energetic submission to the ACCC in the course of the digital platforms inquiry, suggesting that the Copyright Agency was the kind of body that actually was needed in this environment, where it serves as a collecting society to consolidate monies and then, according to the degree of usage through sampling technologies, is able to distribute those monies out to individual authors or publishers as is relevant. The ACCC is generally disinclined to support collecting society models. And there are a number of collecting society models in Australia. The Australian Performing Rights Association is a very obvious one. The Phonographic Performance Company of Australia is another one. Screen Rights and the Copyright Agency are the other two major ones. They seem to me to be the logical bodies to involve in this process because they exist, they operate under the Copyright Act, and ultimately it is about copyright. The digital companies use material without properly compensating the true owners of that material.
Well, we'd have to change Rob Sims' mind because at the moment, judging by his responses to interviews with various journalists, he's not been thinking that way. He's thinking his mandatory code of conduct is only going to benefit the major media companies, ones with a national focus, nothing about regional or community websites. News content that is clicked on and searched, his thinking at the moment seems to be very narrow.
Well, the ACCC has a long history of being disinclined to endorse anything that relates to copyright. The ACCC doesn't like copyright as a concept, and as you'll know, has had some fairly strenuous policy proposals about getting rid of parallel importation in the book and recording industries.
Quentin, I might ask you, we saw a kind of just as the pandemic was hitting, that AAP was in some pretty serious trouble, and that was obviously just as this crisis hit. But for people who don't necessarily know the role of AAP, what kind of function does that perform, and why has that been such an important new service?
Well, it was a long history, AAP, and it was a conglomerate of various media companies who wanted a spine for their coverage, more journal of record objective, if I can say that, journalism, what's happening today, what's on the news list. Photography, getting photographers out there, and anybody could buy into it. You could buy an AAP service, and it was quite a good functioning model. But for various reasons, there's a lot of scepticism about the decision to knock it on the head. The major players determined to end it. The Butte news is, Ebony, that some other people have come in and have been negotiating with it. They've stopped the redundancy packages for the AAP staff, as I understand it at the moment. And we're all hoping that there is a rescue benefactor who's going to take over AAP. And that would be a very good result for all media players in Australia.
And Richard, over the summer period, we saw how important the ABC was in its role as an emergency broadcaster. And certainly I think it's played a huge role, particularly with Norman Swan, the health reporter, kind of heading up their pandemic coverage. But where does the ABC fit into all this as a public broadcaster, as opposed to a commercial media outfit?
Look, great question. I think when we talk about the Australian media landscape, we obviously have to talk about the national broadcaster at the same time. And one of my fears with the way this debate's going, I don't mean ours today, I mean the community debate about the media, is that we're talking a lot about how you can't expect newspapers to deliver good journalism without reliable, sufficient funding. You can't expect TV stations to do it without reliable, secure funding. But of course, we've been cutting funding to the ABC. So if we all take for granted that you can't have good journalism without secure funding, then I think we have to talk about funding for the ABC in the same breath as we're talking about how to help the commercial media operators. And at the same time, at the other end of the scale, I think we have to be very, very careful in the way that the ACCC goes about this task, because as Quentin said, if we're just going to find a way to support existing media companies that are already significant at a national scale, well, how are we going to have vibrancy and competition in our media landscape in the coming years? If we went back 10 years, there was no Guardian in Australia. So if we were designing this system 10 years ago, we'd have left the Guardian out. If a new entrant wants to enter, do they instantly become available for this funding? Do new smaller entrants get a larger share of the revenue pool than they might be warranted to help them grow? Or do they get a smaller share because they haven't proved their worth yet? These are fundamental questions about competition policy as well as fundamental questions about the media landscape. And I think we have to be very careful in designing this scheme that we don't come up with something that delivers only for existing players at existing scale. But at the same time, yes, we need to develop a system that does deliver something from Facebook and Google to those players. So it's a very careful balancing act that's required here. And it's not just a media question. It's not just a competition question. It's very much a political question. And yeah, I don't think we can just flick it to the experts at the ACCC to tell us what the answer is.
Well, that, I think, Richard, that comes back to the core issue, that it is in fact a copyright question in that content is owned by people who publish that material, whether that's a little enterprise in a town like Muswellbrook or a large national media company. And so it comes back to how you actually account for the amount of material that is available and how that gets used and how that is managed by a disinterested player that can properly distribute monies across the board in a fair and entirely unbiased way through a thing like a collecting society. It's the only real model that has ever been developed for being able to distribute properly deserved revenues to the originators of material in a dispassionate way that doesn't actually have any kind of fear or favour to any one player.
And that would allow us to build a creative Australia from any brainstormer or any entrepreneur or anybody wanting to create original content. I just hope somebody, a field agent for Rod Sims, is watching this. There's another issue too that's raised in the Fin Review today, Ebony, and that is that Rod wanted to cut the ABC in on the revenue from Google and Facebook. And my concern, being biased in favour of a properly funded public broadcast, of course, is the ScoMo and Matthias Cormann from the Expenditure Review Committee would immediately discount the ABC's appropriation from any money they did earn. So that's a vexed question about the ABC earning money from advertising through Google and Facebook revenues.
Kim, do you think that would be a concern for the public broadcaster?
Well, I think the ABC is entitled to remuneration for content that is deployed by Google, Facebook and other social media or digital platform providers in the same way as anybody else. As to the consequences for that money being offset against budgetary allocations, I think that's a fight that has to be had. But I don't think that it in any way derogates from the fact that the ABC is properly entitled for compensation for the use of its material. Now, the alternate argument, I imagine, is to say, well, the public's already paid for that material and therefore it should be made available freely. If that's the case, then that's the ABC's decision to actually say that as an independent organisation. I don't think that's for the government to say that.
In a competitive market, I think we need a fair, what's called a level playing field. And we want a vibrant commercial media section in Australia, complemented as it always has been since 1932 by the public broadcasters.
So I think we might start going to questions now, if that's all right with the panelists. But I do just want to say hello to the people from all over the country who have joined us today and say thank you and welcome to you all. Hello to Craig from Hobart, to Timmy from Wurundjeri land. We've got someone from the Gold Coast, Callan from Newcastle. We really appreciate you all tuning in today for this important discussion. I'm going to start off with a question from Marcus May. He says that the public is increasingly turning to the ABC for reliable, accurate and timely information through this year of crises because it's trusted. And that despite the ABC's increased costs in doing emergency broadcasting, damages costs to its infrastructure and various other things, that the communications minister announced hundreds of millions of dollars to help rural and regional broadcasting, yet excluded the ABC from that support. So the question to the panel is, why is this government so intent on undermining or destroying the ABC, and what can we do about that? Quentin, I might go to you first.
Well, there's a long history of LNP hostility to the ABC, really backed up by the vilification campaign over the years from various entities in News Corporation, rivalrous media as it is. So it's media rivalry games, vilification of the ABC. You'd think the National Party would really be very strongly supportive of adequate funding for the ABC, particularly for regionals. The ABC, of course, is now Sydney-centric. It's been reduced back to its Sydney-Melbourne redoubts. It's losing its production capacity outside news. There's one big problem, Ebony. The ABC has been too successful. Since the bushfires in digital, the ABC has been number one in this country's news online news websites. It's above News Corporation, and I thought, oh, we don't want that to happen. It should be down about three or four so that the commercial sector gets ahead. You understand what I'm saying, the context of it, that gets ahead, because while the ABC is right at the top, it will face continuing hostility from government, because Michael Miller and Hugh Marks from Nine and News will be in the ear of Paul Fletcher and ScoMo and saying, these bastards, they're taxpayer subsidised, and they're taking all our audience. So it's a dilemma of trust for the ABC. I'm glad the ABC is trusted and it's validated from the taxpayer investment and all that. But it's a political problem in an industry that is under very great distress. I've got my problems with Rupert Murdoch, but at the same time, I want News Corporation and its outlets as local content creators to survive. We just want them to be a little bit more ethical.
Kim, what's your response there?
I think the ABC is an absolutely central institution to Australia and to communicating Australians communicating with each other and being a central trusted source of information. I do think the ABC has a lot to transition into a proper understanding of a digital world. As Quentin, more than anyone will remember, the 7:30 report on television used to be a state-based report with national inputs, and now it is purely a national report with no state-based activity at all. In a proper digitally seamless environment, all of the radio resource of the ABC would, a very long time ago, have migrated into being a seamless provider of text, audio and video material. And I hope that the ABC can accelerate that process, because to be a proper national provider, it needs to actually move into an environment where it is fluent in being able to work with text, audio and video. I understand Quentin's sensitivity about the self-interest of commercial media in confronting the ABC as what they would see as a digital behemoth. The ABC is not a digital behemoth. It is one of many digital players, and it must become utterly fluent in the use and application of digital technologies in order to be an even more vital journalistic resource.
And Ebony, just quickly, I mean, it's interesting. I'm one of the few people that read, you know, most of the newspapers nearly every day. The Australian's campaign against the ABC has some impact, clearly, on the ABC and some impact on our political class. But what we can see from the ratings numbers, it has no impact on the audience at all. The trust in the ABC has gone through the roof, despite the years of critical attention and evaluation that it's been subject to. So it's great to see that the public can spot bullshit when it sees it, and the ABC has never been a more important or more trusted institution. How it uses that cultural power is up to it, but it's accumulated enormous cultural power off the back of, you know, decades of doing a great job, but the bushfires and the pandemic have just enhanced that. Also, I think we need to think bigger picture here as we move to digital. We have the idea of free-to-air television in our kind of psyche, but increasingly accessing content online is expensive. Access to data is expensive, and I think we need to think bigger about access to news. We have a publicly owned National Broadband Corporation. We have a 100% publicly owned NBN. We have 100% publicly owned ABC. Yet I, as a citizen, I have to pay to access content produced by my national broadcaster delivered to me on my national broadband network. In an era where connectivity is increasingly central, in an era where the ABC is relying on the fact that I can access particularly local content online, I think we need to look at how can we make it free to access the ABC's digital content wherever you live in Australia, or otherwise we're going to create a digital divide in a space where historically we've had what we've thought of as free to air.
I've got a question from Wendy Bacon in Sydney. She says she's been looking at the real estate industry and how important is the collapse in real estate advertising these days have still been with us through Domain, realestate.com and so on, and that it's also the mainstay of metro local media. Richard, you were talking about the rivers of gold, but has real estate replaced that?
It's certainly one of the few areas that have held up. I mean, they've always made money out of real estate.
That's not entirely accurate, Richard. I mean, what one has to understand about digital technologies and digital transformation in all operating businesses is there's not a single example where digital technology becomes a dominant supplier, where former revenues are not actually converted from dollars into cents. So that the kinds of mountains of money, the rivers of the so-called rivers of gold in the classifieds of Fairfax, for example, in the old days of the Herald and the Age, were converted into a sum of money operating in a digital domain that is probably at a mere fraction of what was originally there. And the same is true across the whole spectrum of digital life. So that whilst they have created new businesses that have been avowedly profitable, they are but a modicum of what the revenues once were. And often large media companies have had very great difficulty coming to terms with the kind of cruel baseline that is brought into play with digital technology. Particularly when you think in a digital domain, you move from scarcity of supply and therefore pricing power when you have a print format to digital delivery where you have an abundant possibility of infinite supply and therefore pricing collapses. So it's been a very confronting thing for media companies, and media companies have never really transitioned properly to this new operating domain. Compound now, because as we come into a recovery zone from COVID-19, as I'm sure you've read, Richard and Quentin, and Ebony, in a lot of the international commentary, particularly coming from the United States and Canada, retailing is in genuine collapse in the United States. In fact, clothing retailing is down by 60%, and there's a general expectation that it won't rebound. Now, of course, retailing has always been in the heartland of advertising underpinning media delivery. retail ads are fundamentally important in media delivery and still are. I mean, even in print newspapers, you'll see ads from Coles and Woolies on a daily basis in the current settings, informing customers about policies and services that they have available during the COVID outbreak.
And travel's
fundamental. That's quite right, Quentin. So all of those revenue sources have never been under greater threat, so that the problem for media will compound, having come through the first phase of digital change. It's now going to be even more ferociously severe in terms of its revenue impact.
Well, I just wonder what Hugh Marks and Michael Miller told Paul Fletcher to get him to move to the mandatory code to give him try to get the ACCC and Google and Facebook to put some sort of a revenue sharing. I understand Fairfax already has some arrangement with Google, gets them about, somebody reported, I think it was in the AFR, about $20 million that they get. So they're really must have put a heavy lot of pressure on the federal government to move, to accelerate the mandatory code, which is, we're told, going to be a world first after the difficulties of Spain and France. So there's a lot riding on that, as you say, Kim, with the inability of the media companies to make the transition to digital.
Sorry, Richard. Sorry.
Well, just on that, I think, you know, just last week we were having a webinar about the impact of the COVID crisis on the arts industry. And just last week, the government significantly relaxed local content rules, which is a, you know, significant source of cash in the pockets of, you know, a pretty desperate Channel 7 at the moment. But, you know, I think the pressures the government's coming under and perhaps the friends it's trying to make at the moment are much broader than just the media, just the journalism part of the media market. And I think what we're seeing in Australia at the moment is some really radical changes taking place across the communication sector, whether it's entertainment communication or news communication. We're really seeing some quite radical restructuring take place, some of which is good, but all of which I think needs to be evaluated outside of the context of what does it mean to get industries through this crisis. I think we have to have a very clear eye on what does it look like when we come out the other side, because at the moment it looks like we might come out the other side with far lower obligations on commercial TV to buy Australian content and distribute Australian content, and potentially a system where in the news media where we're funding the ABC less, and potentially providing money to large media outlets and stifling competition.
Thanks, Richard. The next question's from Jeff. He says he's a former investigative journalist, Jeff Sermai. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he's worried about the loss of quality journalism and the resources to support it, and wonders what the panellists think about mainstream media still giving the usual amount of space and time to sport, of which there is none at the moment, while not giving much time and space to the arts, and that there's a more creative, new, original and resourceful online arts happening than sports at the moment. Quentin, I might go to you first.
the investigative journalism or the public interest journalism is now a big issue for all of us, let alone what we call a journal of record journalism, and we're discussing, Ebony, the future of AAP in this country. So it's a question of aggregating audiences for commercial operators as usual, there is a very limited investment in investigative journalism in commercial media. Fairfax. The Nines are still having a go at it, thank heavens. But the broader issue is the survival of, as we're discussing with this webinar, the survival of Australian media, including what was called the Metro mastheads. So my real concern is the survival of the Metro mastheads, and at what time they're going to close their printing presses for the last time. That's why we're happy to get Kim on here, because he could answer that question from his experience with News Corporation, with the regional print going, Kim, what's the prospect of the when the metro print will close?
I don't think anyone's got a perfect crystal ball on that, Quentin, but print is a terminating technology for the delivery of news products, in my view. In fact, it's been interesting to see that a number of publications have moved into exclusive digital delivery over the course of the last few weeks, so that The Economist, for the last three issues, has delivered it only digitally, which I've found to be a most interesting change. And I wonder as to whether it will actually return as a print publication. And that's a very successful print publication, probably the most successful weekly news journal anywhere in the world. And one that has continued to grow, I might say, in the digital era. I think it's important we don't confine our thinking in media just to bodies like News Corporation and Nine. I mean, there's clearly a vast body of other suppliers of information now, and that the kind of fragmentation that we've seen as a result of digital technologies and the liberation to many providers of information is very real. I mean, two of the major commentators on politics in America and sources of information in America didn't exist 10 years ago, Politico and The Hill. And Politico and The Hill are sort of compulsory reading for anyone who is interested in what's happening in American politics nationally and regionally. They provide a vast body of information. And, of course, that they wouldn't begin to know how to think in terms of print delivery technologies. They're completely uninterested in those sorts of phenomena.
To answer the question, they provide investigative journalism too.
They do. I mean, Politico regularly breaks major stories, as you know, Quentin.
We've got Michael West and The Guardian adding to it. So it is dynamic, as you say. We really should think wider now.
Sorry, I'll just get back to the actual question, and Richard, I'll come to you in a second. But, Kim, you've actually got a long history in the arts. Do you think, generally speaking, we devote too much time to sports rather than the arts?
I personally think that's the case, but that's evidence of my own personal proclivities and devotions. I know that the audience is more complex than that. I would always be an advocate for increasing arts coverage and increasing coverage about creative and intellectual life in our nation. I think it's tremendously important. In fact, I think it's the crucible of our future. But in terms of the hard judgments that often get made editorially, the arts clearly has been an area that has been under increasing law of diminishing returns in terms of reportage on the arts. That said, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald still provide significant coverage of creative life in our country. And, of course, the Australian does also. It has a daily page that is devoted to matters to do with creative life in theatre, music and a whole range of other areas. I mean, that's recently been rebranded in terms of the kind of home-based life that we're all living at the moment. But it still has a huge amount of material about creative endeavour.
On
the investigative journalism issue, I think it's a tremendously important issue. And I think it is incumbent upon all of us not only to be advocates for the ABC, but also to be advocates for actually supporting good journalism with our own dollars in a variety of different ways. We need many voices. We need many perspectives in dealing with the kinds of complexities that the world confronts now. And it's been interesting to see the way in which The Guardian has been able to secure a very steady stream of money from Australians stepping up and putting money in the plate to actually make The Guardian operate in Australia.
Richard, I know in the past you've talked about the fact that the ABC runs a program called The Business, but there's no equivalent called The Unions or Civil Society. What do you think about that question of arts versus sports?
It actually raises the fundamental issue about, you know, what we're talking about with media and media diversity. The simple fact is the gambling industry are one of the biggest advertisers. They're one of the few sectors that are growing, and we gamble on sport and we don't gamble on the arts. So the commercial TVs have a very strong incentive to not just put sport on, but to talk about sport a lot, because what they're actually doing is creating a platform for the gambling industry to advertise on. And that cuts to the heart of the complexity of this whole conversation. Who decides what's news? Who decides what we need to know about? Because, you know, once upon a time, people who could deliver classified car ads got to decide what news is. Now people who can deliver gambling ads get to decide what's culturally important. And that's never going to change in the commercial media landscape, which, as Kim said, is far more diverse than the traditional masthead newspapers. I mean, what about podcasts, for example? Are they news? Well, sometimes. Are they investigative journalism? Sometimes. So we have to, you know, really get out of the silos that we're in. And, you know, here I am sitting in the Australia Institute. Do we do research? Yes. Do we do analysis? Yes. Do we do public commentary that helps people understand what's going on? Yes. So, you know, this conversation, I don't mean ours today, I mean the national debate about this is far more complex than Rod Sims and I think the government are letting on, because what is news and who decides what's news, they're very important questions, and a glimpse at history tells us that access to certain sources of revenue gives you enormous cultural power to decide what's important. Now, if it's going to be the federal government through the ACCC handing out that money, who they decide to hand it to is going to have a huge impact on what we decide is news.
I'll just come now. I've noticed Amanda Mead we've got on the line. Amanda, I'm not sure if you've got a question for the panel.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah.
I'm very interested in whether this pandemic will speed up the end of printed newspapers. I know Kim has already said that, you know, papers are terminal, and noted what's going on with The Economist. And obviously a lot of the smaller regional papers have already stopped printing and probably won't come back. So I just wanted to ask if the panellists thought there was a chance that some of the bigger papers might not continue printing for very long.
Thanks, Amanda. And I'll just also add, we've got a couple of questions from the Q&A of people specifically asking about regional papers. So if you could speak to that as well. Kim, we'll go to you first. Thanks, Amanda.
I don't think it's a question of if print newspapers stop being produced. It's only a matter of when. And I would think in regional Australia, that decision is probably sooner rather than later. And in the capital cities, it will be a matter of some years, but it certainly won't be a matter of a decade.
Quentin?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. What we've got to do is, all of us interested in the survival of the media, local media in Australia, we should look at exactly what the subscription base of each entity, each masthead is. Look at their advertising revenue and look at their circulation. I understand the News Corporation publications around Australia have got about 650,000 circulation. Their digital subscriptions are going up about 4% a year. Fairfax Age and, sorry, Nine Age and Herald about 150,000 circulation, the bulk of it on the weekends. We've got to look at exactly when those boards will make that decision that there's not enough advertising revenue coming in to print. I think the Nine newspapers make more money on their print, so that print will survive for the time being. But with COVID-19, it will really sharpen the focus of those boards about when do you make the jump to fully digital. And that's why this mandatory code, if they can lock that away and get some underwriting from Google and Facebook, that would assist them to make the transition.
Richard, I wondered if I might just chime in with a question from Bob Burton here. He's from the Tasmanian Inquirer, and he was interested in the panel's thoughts on the prospects for the growth of non-profit media in Australia. Richard?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is my point. Like, what is a newspaper? What is a news outlet? What is source of news that is worthy, in inverted commas, of government support if we can succeed in getting a lot of money out of Facebook and Google? It could be a wonderful time for diverse competitive media outlets, particularly at local scale. You know, parts of Tasmania are obviously not well serviced by national newspapers. It could be a wonderful era for community organisations to set up their own local news services. But what's the definition of news? Again, historically, we didn't have to answer that question. It was left to, can you get enough advertising to justify calling yourself a news outlet? But once there's public funding involved, then that's a radically different proposition. So yeah, there's nothing to stop the growth of community and not-for-profit news outlets.
But that's clearly already happening. I mean, in a big ticket way, the Conversation is a very strong example of one aspect of a particular portion of the community that is publishing very vigorously. The Guardian operates on a pay if you want to model, and then there are countless other organisations that produce regular digital publications that celebrate independent thinking. Some of them are modest and some of them are extreme, but they're all out there. And they're all part of the panoply of a very lively polity. I think it's important that we recognise all of that activity is taking place, and that news investigation and commentary reposes in a vastly wider landscape than at any time in human history. And now, often it's very easy to go down rabbit holes in that process, and it's often very, very dispiriting that those rabbit holes are just echo chambers that amplify views of varying degrees of extremity. But it is part of the fabric of our new lives that we all need to navigate and manage. Is there a role for funding by government in that environment? I think probably so. It's a complex question, and it has many, many, many difficult philosophical issues. There's a large vote for saying, if you care about things, get together and make something happen. And I think we're going to see a lot more community activism in that way. And we're already seeing it. I mean, we obviously see it already in the environment movement in a most pronounced way. But in the arts, we see many examples of that. I think that will grow. I mean, arts in this country has declined from federal sources by 20% over the last decade, which has had a profoundly severe impact on creative life in our country. Writing is actually receiving the same level of funding today that it was receiving 30 years ago. This is a tragedy for our country. But the only way out of it is to actually see the sort of community activism that Richard's describing. And one of the virtues of digital technology is that at least it enables and facilitates that kind of advocacy.
Anita Jacoby, do I have you on the line there?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Do you have a question for the panel?
Look, I'm really interested. I mean, obviously, this is a really good, robust discussion. I'm interested if you see any opportunities whatsoever coming out of COVID-19 in the media sector and what those opportunities might look like, if any.
Quentin, I'll start with you.
Well, I suppose what is great for the lifting of audiences across the board. All media audiences have gone up through COVID-19. And that is the dynamic question of getting information out to the public. Now, whether this can be maintained with other great national debates, I mean, we've got to have a debate about the recovery, not just the Canberra bubble politics about who's going to win the next bloody election, but what are we going to do to reshape Australia? So if all media could engage with their audiences and their readership and their viewers and listeners and create content that actually engages much more viscerally with the Australian public. That would be a quality lift in our... We've got a very intelligent, educated population in Australia, and we should be playing up to them, not playing to their prejudices and trying to get what has evolved from the national cabinet level of resolving matters to lift the media, the quality of Australian media. So something good has come out of that. To get compliance on the lockdowns, or substantial compliance on the lockdowns on the basis of a pretty poor advertising effort by the federal government, I must say, but from the media coverage and engagement, animated graphics explaining, informing, engaging audiences have been very good. To get compliance on the lockdowns has been a major success, and the media has been a big part of that. I'm being very proud of all the journalists and program makers of Australia in getting this country to put the boot into the pollies when is absolutely necessary on clash of strategy. But to get the media to do that on a continuing basis would be a great benefit from COVID-19.
Kim, what do you think the opportunities are?
I think someone was saying that I'm talking too much, so Richard should respond.
Richard, what about you?
Oh, no, it's great to have you on, Kim. We're already talking about a big opportunity. For the first time, the federal government's come out and said, look, voluntary codes aren't going to cut it. We're going to force Google and Facebook to the table. So that's a big change. You know, we need to really think through what the long-term design of that is, but that's quite a radical change in not just the Australian media landscape, but in the interaction between the Australian government and the business community. To step in and compel something like that's really quite significant. Look, as Quentin said, traffic's through the roof. That tells us all something very important. People take the Australian media very seriously and they trust the Australian media. And I actually think that one of the reasons that Australia is doing such a good job of dealing with COVID-19 is that we do have a diverse but professional media who've taken this issue far more seriously than, let's face it, they've taken issues like climate change in the past. And I think that science is being taken seriously. I think diversity of opinion is being taken seriously. And while there's clearly conflicting views out there in the community, I think the media has done a good job of putting them all up and letting their readers decide who to listen to. So I think that that's a really valuable lesson for everyone in the Australian media, that you can actually host a sophisticated and complicated debate through the media without shooting the messenger all the time. And when you do that, people actually tune in.
Kim, we're about to run out of time, and we've got probably only time for one last question, and this one's got the most number of upvotes, which is how do you challenge the Murdoch empire? And surely it must be broken up in the interest of public discourse. And if I can add to that, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull was talking about News Corp Australia acting as a political party. I just wonder if we might sum up with your response to those.
Well, I certainly think that media has reverted in many parts of its life to the origins of media, which was to advance personal views by proprietors. The whole origin of news media back in the 18th and 19th century was from individuals actually prosecuting certain cases they wished to advocate to the community or to those in power. And so I would call it as a sort of a flight to predictable polarities. I think what the problem, and what I'm surprised at the severity of Malcolm Turnbull's comments, because it attributes a level of power to old media that I don't think it has any longer. And that we've seen that, to go back to what Richard was saying, we've seen that in the last couple of elections where very, very heavy advocacy was advanced one way, and the public behaved in quite the opposite way, and seen most particularly in New South Wales with the advocacy of the Daily Telegraph, and the public basically said, "Root your boot."
I think
in Queensland also, of course, in Queensland where you saw those astonishing outcomes several years ago. I'm personally pretty irritated by the term Canberra bubble, but I think Malcolm Turnbull is certainly living absolutely the centre of the Canberra bubble in describing his departure from politics as being all about the Murdoch press. I think it had that may have been a minor contributing factor, but I think he needs to look around him at all of his political colleagues much more carefully.
Quentin?
Malcolm's contribution about pointing an accusatory finger at Murdoch and the News Corporation editors was about the only redeeming feature I found in his memoir. And it goes to what has been an historic distortion by News Corporation I've been complaining about to our the operation of our democracy. And because they target, and Malcolm, I think, had substantive evidence, Kim, that News Corporation had an unreal disproportionate influence within the numbers within his caucus, within his party room, to the point where numbers were shifting against him. So
perhaps more influential with the Canberra bubble than with the public, as Kim was pointing
that's
out.
That's true. Kim's made a very good point, but I think inside the Liberal Party room there was a very real influence there.
And yeah. Richard, sorry?
Oh, look, I think it's very important. So I don't think the power of the Murdoch media is so much overstated as misunderstood. What they have the power to do is shape an agenda. They have the power to really line up a politician and make their life a misery. And so they're better at destroying than building. So when News Limited goes for someone, they can do real harm. But as we've seen from New South Wales state elections and Queensland state elections, that doesn't mean they can actually deliver someone into government. So I think we need to, they do have enormous power. Let's not pretend they don't. But that power is really only usable in a particular direction. But in terms of diversity, I think it's also important to point out that, you know, look, we've not just got The Guardian in recent years, we've actually got News old-fashioned printed Saturday paper from Schwartz Media and the Monthly and the Quarterly Essay, and all these kind of innovations that are taking place aren't all happening online, but there is lots of innovation going on. And, you know, we need to see the power of the old media for what it is. I don't think we need to write it off. It's very important. What we need to understand is where the country needs the media to get to, and make sure we have a rigorous debate about what kind of media we want, not which media proprietor we're barracking for.
Well, that seems like a good and positive note to end on, so we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much to all of our guests today, Kim Williams, Quentin Dempster and Richard Dennis. Thank you so much for your time.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so stay tuned. For the latest health information, please check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. The Australia Institute's next webinar will be about Australia after the crisis, with special guest Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers. That's next Wednesday, the 29th of April at 11 a.m. This episode was recorded on Wednesday, the 22nd of April, 2020, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Quentin Dempster is at Quentin Dempster. Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with help from River McCrossan. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Wash your hands regularly, don't go outside unless you have to, and thanks for listening.